itself. But only on the downside. You can't fix a deadline and then add more work to it. That's not fair. Our projects can only get smaller over time, not larger. As we progress, we separate the must-haves from the nice-to-haves and toss out the non-essentials. And who makes the decision about what stays and what goes in a fixed period of time? The team that's working on it. Not the CEO, not the CTO. The team that's doing the work has control over the work. They wield the scope hammer, as we call it. They can crush the big must-haves into smaller pieces and then judge each piece individually and objectively. Then they can sort, sift, and decide what's worth keeping and what can wait. It's critical that the scope be flexible on the downside, because almost everything that can take 6 months can also be done in some other form in 6 weeks. Likewise, small projects balloon into large projects all the time if you're not careful. It's all about knowing where to cut, when to say stop, and when to move on. Another way to think about our deadlines is that they're based on budgets, not estimates. We're not fans of estimates because, let's face it, humans suck at estimating. But it turns out that people are quite good at setting and spending budgets. If we tell a team that they have 6 weeks to build a great calendar feature in Basecamp, they're much more likely to produce lovely work than if we ask them how long it'll take to build this specific calendar feature and then break their weekends and backs to make it so. A deadline with a flexible scope invites pushback, compromises, and trade-offs. All ingredients in healthy, calm projects. It's when you try to fix both scope and time that you have a recipe for dread, overwork, and exhaustion. Here are some of the telltale signs that your deadline is really a dreadline. An unreasonably large amount of work that needs to be done in an unreasonably short amount of time. This massive redesign and reorganization needs to happen in 2 weeks. Yeah, I know half the team is out on vacation next week, but that's not my problem. An unreasonable expectation of quality given the resources and time. We can't compromise on quality. Every detail must be perfect by Friday, whatever it takes. An ever-expanding amount of work in the same time frame as originally promised. The CEO just told me that we also need to launch this in Spanish and Italian, not just English. Constraints are liberating, and realistic deadlines with flexible scopes can be just that. But they require you to embrace budgets and shun estimates. Great work will fill the time allotted if you allow it to. Don't be a knee-jerk. At most companies, people put together a deck, reserve a conference room, and call a meeting to pitch a new idea. If they're lucky, no one interrupts them while they're presenting. But usually someone jumps in and derails the presentation after 2 minutes. When it's over, people react. This is precisely the problem. The person making the pitch has presumably put a lot of time, thought, and energy into gathering their thoughts and presenting them clearly to an audience. But the rest of the people in the room are asked to react. Not absorb, not think it over, not consider. Just react. Knee-jerk it. That's no way to treat fragile new ideas. At Basecamp, we flip the script. When we present work, it's almost always written up first, a complete idea in the form of a carefully composed multi-page document, illustrated whenever possible. And then it's posted to Basecamp, which lets everyone involved know there's a complete idea waiting to be considered. Considered! We don't want reactions. We don't want first impressions. We don't want knee-jerks. We want considered feedback. Read it over. Read it twice. Three times even. Sleep on it. Take your time to gather and present your thoughts, just like the person who pitched the original idea took their time to gather and present theirs. That's how you go deep on an idea. Sometimes when people pitch ideas at Basecamp, there will be radio silence for a few days before a flood of feedback comes in. That's fine. And expected. Imagine a silent room after a physical meeting-style pitch. it would be awkward. And that's precisely why we prefer to present out of person, not in person. We want silence and consideration to feel natural, not anxiety-provoking. When we pitch this way, we're effectively forcing the floor. No one can interrupt the presenter because there's no one there to interrupt. The idea is shared whole. There's no room to stop someone, no opportunity to break someone's flow. They have the floor and it can't be taken away. And then when you're ready to present your feedback, the floor is yours. Give it a try sometime. Don't meet. Write. Don't react. Consider. Watch out for 12-day weeks. Way back when, we used to release new software on Fridays all the time. That often meant working Saturdays and Sundays to fix an urgent problem with the new stuff, wrecking the weekend for whoever did the release. It was stupid, yet predictable, because we kept setting deadlines at the end of a week. But Friday is the worst day to release anything. First off, you probably rush to finish, so work done on Fridays tends to be a bit sloppy. Second, Mondays don't come after Fridays. Saturdays and Sundays come after Fridays. So if something goes wrong, you're working the weekend. Third, if you work the weekends, you don't get a chance to recharge. Basically, when you've worked all week and you're forced to work the weekend, the following Monday is the eighth day of the last week, not the first day of next week. This means that if you keep working through that following week, you're working 12-day weeks. That's no good. So here we are, creating unnecessary stress for ourselves. Stress that not only existed in the moment, but that also lingered into the following week. Why? We couldn't come up with a good reason. So instead of shipping big software updates on Fridays, we now wait until Monday the following week to do it. Yes, this introduced other risks. If we somehow make a big mistake, we're introducing it on the busiest day of the week. But knowing that also helps us be better prepared for the release. When there's more at stake, you tend to measure twice, cut once. This encouraged us to take quality assurance more seriously, so we can catch more issues ahead of time. Reducing release day stress was a multi-pronged approach. First comes recognition, then comes remediation. Today, shipping new software at Basecamp is almost entirely stress-free. There will always be some butterflies in the stomach. Even a professional musician or public speaker gets nervous when they go on stage in front of a huge crowd. But stressed out, we are not. And if we're feeling frenzied for any reason, we delay the release until we've calmed down. The poet and civil rights activist Maya Angelou preferred to write alone in a modest hotel room and would wrap up at 2 p.m., giving herself enough time to decompress before dinner with her husband. The new normal. Normal comes on quick. First, it starts as an outlier, some behavior you don't love but tolerate. Then someone else follows suit, but either you miss it or you let it slide. Then people pile on, repeating what they've seen because no one stepped in to course correct. Then it's too late. It's become the culture, the new normal. This happens in organizations all the time. A single snarky remark can cascade into a storm of collective snark in the same way that a single spark can ignite a forest fire. And implicitly, when you let it happen, it becomes okay. Behavior unchecked becomes behavior sanctioned. We've gone down this path a number of times at Basecamp. There was a time when someone working a difficult case with a difficult customer could vent disparagingly in a company chat room, and nobody would say anything. Or we'd all rip on a company that made a mistake, forgetting that people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. We kinda knew it wasn't right, but we didn't stop it, which just made it that much harder when we finally decided enough was enough. Unwinding the new normal requires far more effort than preventing that new normal from being set in the first place. If you don't want gnarly roots in your culture, you have to mind the seeds. You don't have to let something slide for long before it becomes the new normal. Culture is what culture does. Culture isn't what you intend it to be. It's not what you hope or aspire for it to be. It's what you do. So do better. Bad habits beat good intentions. Micromanagers tend to stay micromanagers. Workaholics tend to stay workaholics. Hustlers tend to stay hustlers. What we do repeatedly hardens into habits. The longer you carry on, the tougher it is to change. All your best intentions about doing the right thing later are no match for the power of habits. Yet people deceive themselves all the time. They think they can put in long hours for years, so I won't have to do it later. You may not have to do it, but you probably will do it, because it's a habit. Right from the beginning of Basecamp, we insisted on a reasonable work week. We didn't pull all-nighters to make impossible deadlines. We scoped the work to fit a good day's work and then enjoyed a calm evening off. Not by magic, not by luck, but by choice. If we had started by hiring a bunch of people we didn't need in the beginning, we would have continued to hire a bunch more people we don't need today. Instead, we hire when it hurts. Slowly, and only after we clearly need someone, not in anticipation of possibly maybe. If we had started by forcing everyone to come into the office to work, we'd almost certainly believe that the only way to work together would be to see each other face to face every day. Instead, today we have people working full-time for us in dozens of cities around the world. They work at their own pace, in their own place. When calm starts early, calm becomes the habit. But if you start crazy, it'll define you. You have to keep asking yourself if the way you're working today is the way you'd want to work in 10, 20, or 30 years. If not, now is the time to make a change, not later. Later is where excuses live. Later is where good intentions go to die. Later is a broken back and a bent spirit. Later says, all-nighters are temporary until we've got this figured out. Unlikely. Make the change now. Independencies. Few question the assumption that a company should always strive to move in sync. Team A providing Team B with exactly what they need, exactly when they need it. All lined up, beautifully choreographed. But such a ballet of interdependence is a performance we'd rather skip. We want our teams to be able to glide by one another independently rather than get tripped up in lockstep. Things should fit together rather than stick together. Dependencies are tangled, intertwined teams, groups, or individuals that can't move independently of one another. Whenever someone is waiting on someone else, there's a dependency in the way. If you're building airplanes or working an assembly line, fine. That's probably required. But most companies these days aren't, yet they still work as if they are. We've fallen into the dependency trap a few times. For example, we used to try to line up release schedules for our web app and mobile apps. If we had something new on the web app, it had to wait until the iPhone and Android versions also had it before we could release everything. That slowed us down, tangled us up, and led to self-imposed frustrations. In the end, Android users didn't care whether they were using exactly the same design as iPhone users. We also frequently used to bundle 5 or 6 major new features together in one big bang release, rather than shipping each new improvement when ready. It makes for a great splash, but big bang releases bundle the risk from every component, so if one thing falls behind, the whole thing can get held up, which it always does. So you end up with a much higher risk of significantly delayed delivery or, at worst, having to scrap everything. Throwing away a bunch of work simply because of the way you worked on it is a morale gut punch. But that's what happens when your work is filled with dependencies. Today we ship things when they're ready rather than when they're coordinated. If it's ready for the web, ship it. iOS will catch up when they're ready. Or if iOS is first, Android will get there when they're ready. The same is true for the web. Customers get the value when it's ready wherever, not when it's ready everywhere. So don't tie more knots. Cut more ties. The fewer bonds, the better. Commitment, not consensus. The gold standard for legal deliberations is a unanimous verdict by a jury of peers. When the stakes of justice are at their highest, consensus is the only thing that'll do. Anything less, and it's a do-over. That's a wonderful ideal for a criminal court, but it's a terrible practice to mimic in business. If you only have to make a single decision, and it might literally be life or death, then that's a burden worth bearing. But in business, you may have to make multiple major decisions monthly. If every one of them has to be made by consensus, you're in for an endless grind with significant collateral damage. The cost of consensus is simply too much to pay over and over again. When you get a bunch of people in a room under the assumption that consensus is the only way out again, you're in for a war of attrition. Whoever can keep arguing the longest stands the best chance of winning. That's just silly. So what to do instead? It's not like good decisions just spring into the mind of a single individual. They're always going to be the product of consultation, evidence, arguments, and debate. But the only sustainable method in business is to have them made by individuals. Someone in charge has to make the final call, even if others would prefer a different decision. Good decisions don't so much need consensus as they need commitment. Jeff Bezos put it well in his 2017 letter to shareholders. I disagree and commit all the time. We recently greenlit a particular Amazon Studios original. I told the team my view. Debatable whether it would be interesting enough, complicated to produce, the business terms aren't that good, and we have lots of other opportunities. They had a completely different opinion and wanted to go ahead. I wrote back right away with, I disagree and commit and hope it becomes the most watched thing we've ever made. Consider how much slower this decision cycle would have been if the team had actually had to convince me rather than simply get my commitment. We totally agree. We've been practicing disagree and commit since the beginning, but it took Bezos's letter to name the practice. Now we even use that exact term in our discussions. I disagree, but let's commit. Is something you'll hear at Basecamp after heated debates about specific products or strategy decisions. Companies waste an enormous amount of time and energy trying to convince everyone to agree before moving forward on something. What they'll often get is reluctant acceptance that masks secret resentment. Instead, they should allow everyone to be heard and then turn the decision over to one person to make the final call. It's their job to listen, consider, contemplate, and decide. Calm companies get this. Everyone's invited to pitch their ideas, make their case, and have their say. But then the decision is left to someone else. As long as people are truly heard and it's repeatedly demonstrated that their voice matters, those who shared will understand that, even if things don't fall their way this time. Last thing, what's especially important in disagree and commit situations is that the final decision should be explained clearly to everyone involved. It's not just decide and go. It's decide, explain, and go. Compromise on quality. We compromise on quality all the time at Basecamp. We launch features that aren't good enough for everyone, but will be just fine for plenty of people. We duct tape bugs when they're not bad enough to warrant a true root cause fix. We publish essays on our blog that may have a grammatical error or two. You just can't bring your A game to every situation. Knowing when to embrace good enough is what gives you the opportunity to be truly excellent when you need to be. We're not suggesting you put shit work out there. You need to be able to be proud of it, even if it's only okay. But attempting to be indiscriminately great at everything is a foolish waste of energy. Rather than put endless effort into every detail, we put lots of effort into separating what really matters from what sort of matters from what doesn't matter at all. The act of separation should be your highest quality endeavor. It's easy to say, everything has to be great, but anyone can do that. The challenge lies in figuring out where you can be just kinda okay, or even downright weak. Think of it this way. If you do one thing at 100%, you've spent 100% to get that one thing. If you spend 20% each on getting 5 things to 80%, well then, you've done 5 things. We'll almost always take that trade. Being clear about what demands excellence and what's perfectly okay just being adequate is a great way to bring a sense of calm into your work. You'll worry less, you'll accept more. That's fine is such a wonderfully relaxing way to work most of the time. Save the occasional scrutiny for the differentiating details that truly matter. Narrow as you go. It's almost impossible to work on something and not be tempted to chase all the exciting new what if and we could also ideas that come up. There's always one more thing it could do, one more improvement it should have. But if you actually want to make progress, you have to narrow as you go. After the initial dust settles, the work required to finish a project should be dwindling over time, not expanding. The deadline should be comfortably approaching, not scarily arriving. Remember, deadlines, not dreadlines. When we spend 6 weeks on something, the first week or two is for clarifying unknowns and validating assumptions. This is the time when the concept needs to hit reality and either bounce if it's sound or shatter if it's not. That's why we quickly begin prototyping as soon as we can in those first 2 weeks. We're often looking at something real within a day or two. Nothing tells the truth like actually experiencing the idea in real life. That's the first time we know if what we had in our heads is actually going to work or not. But after that, brief period of exploration at the beginning of a project, it's time to focus in and get narrow. It's time for tunnel vision. This runs against the church of endless exploration, that constant chase for the better idea. If we just brainstormed a little more, riffed a little more, explored a little more, pulled in a few more people to collaborate with, nope. Once the initial exploration is over, every week should lead us closer to being done, not further from it. Commit to an idea. See it through. Make it happen. You can always go back later, but only if you actually finish. Week 4 of a 6-week project should be about finishing things up and ramping things down, not coming up with big new ideas. It's not that new approaches or ideas are bad, but their timing may well be. Always keeping the door open to radical changes only invites chaos and second-guessing. Confidently close that door. Accept that better ideas aren't necessarily better if they arrive after the train has left the station. If they're so good, they can catch the next one. That's really the answer to new ideas that arrive too late. You'll just have to wait. Why not nothing? Doing nothing isn't an option. Oh, yes, it is. And it's often the best one. Nothing should always be on the table. Change makes things worse all the time. It's easier to fuck up something that's working well than it is to genuinely improve it. But we commonly delude ourselves into thinking that more time, more investment, more attention is always going to win. Case in point, we were working on revamping the way clients and firms work together using Basecamp. We were planning on replacing the old way with a new way. That meant, at some point, moving everyone who used the old way over to the new way. That meant migrating data, converting formats, and showing an entirely different experience in their faces. But what if someone liked the old way? Or not even liked it, but simply was comfortable with it? Sometimes we assume that someone has to like or dislike something. Often, They just get used to something and that's what they prefer. Taking that away is a violent act, not a gentle one. So halfway through the project, we paused. What if we did nothing? No forced change, no migration, no new experience for those who preferred the old way? What if existing customers could use what they already had, and we only gave the new way to new customers who never knew the old way? So that's what we did. Nothing. No forced migration. No requirement to learn something new. No hard sell on how this is actually better. Things would stay exactly as they were for current customers, but they could also opt into the new approach if they wanted to. Nothing was better for customers. And self-servingly, nothing was better for us too. It meant less work. It meant shrinking the project. It meant shaving weeks off the deadline. And it meant shipping sooner. Nothing was better. Sometimes you have to fight against the obvious. And sometimes you have to recognize the time in doesn't equal benefits out. Doing nothing can be the hardest choice, but the strongest too. It's enough. Calm requires getting comfortable with enough. While there's no hardline definition of when's enough or what's enough in every situation, one thing's for sure. If it's never enough, then it'll always be crazy at work. A few years ago, we looked at the time it took to answer emails from customers. Sometimes it took hours. While that might seem fast to a lot of people accustomed to waiting days for a reply, it wasn't fast enough for us. So we started by setting a target. 1 hour. The vast majority of the hundreds of customers writing to us every day should get a response within 1 hour. No autoresponders, just real humans. Real fast. To do that, we hired up. Plastered the fast response promise on our website. Started responding quicker and quicker, and began beaming with pride at our newfound capability. Then we got greedy for more. Hey, if we can get down to 1 hour, why not 30 minutes? So we did that. Why not 15 minutes? So we did that. Why not 2 minutes? So we did that. Seriously, 2 minutes. Some and even 1 minute. And why not, right? Why not be as fast as possible? You can never get back to people fast enough, right? Wrong. Answering hundreds of emails every day within a minute or two just isn't sustainable. The team that had beamed with pride over hitting those numbers started getting stressed out. Some began to feel bad if they took 3 minutes to get back to someone when our average response time was only 2 minutes. Imagine that. Feeling bad about getting back to a customer within 3 minutes. We had stumbled into an unrealistic goal of, we can never get back to people fast enough. And it was taking its toll. It was amazing that it could be done, but we had forgotten to ask whether it should be done. So we pulled back. No doubt customers loved hearing back from us quickly. Many of them told us so. They were amazed, really. But as we found, they were equally amazed at 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or even within the hour. Their expectations were that they'd either never hear back, or it would take maybe a day or so. So to hear back and say 15 minutes just blew them away all the same. We just needed to be fast enough, and 15 minutes was fast enough. Even within the hour was fast enough. That popped the pressure release valve on our team, too. Everyone calmed down. They could spend more time thinking, helping, and writing, and less time rushing. Everything got better. Customers remained thrilled with our fast service, which was a bit slower than before, but still way ahead of the industry. And our team chilled out and did better work. Win-win. Not only was it enough, it was plenty. Worst practices. Every mature industry is drowning in best practices. There are best practices about how to price a product, conduct employee reviews, do content marketing, design a website, or make an app scalable to millions of users. There's no end to advice claiming to be the best. Yet so much of it is not merely bullshit, but quite possibly the worst thing you could do. What counts as the best practice for a company of 10,000 is very rarely so for a company of 10. Hell, even our own internal best practices at Basecamp that were set when we only had 7 people at the company failed or held us back when we grew to 30. We've frequently been trapped by things that used to work well, but no longer do. And it's not just about a difference in size. It's a difference in everything. Are you selling a service for a recurring fee or a product for a one-time cost? Different practices. Are you just designing for a single awesome iPhone app, or are you trying to reach Android, the web, and email as well? Different practices. Are you building your company to last, or are you starting with an exit strategy in mind? Different practices. Have your people worked together for a long time, or are you building a brand new team from scratch? Different practices. There are many reasons to be skeptical of best practices, but one of the most common is when you see someone deriving them purely from outside observations about how another company does it. Top 10 best practices for how Apple develops products. Has that person worked on a product development team at Apple? No. They're simply coming to their own conclusions based on their own assumptions about how they think things work. Unless you've actually done the work, you're in no position to encode it as a best practice. Furthermore, many best practices are purely folklore. No one knows where they came from, why they started, and why they continue to be followed. But because of that powerful label, best practice, people often forget to even question them. Someone much smarter than us must have come up with them, right? Everyone who follows them is experiencing great success, right? If we aren't doing well by them, it's got to be our fault, right? Most of those rights are probably wrongs. What's more, best practices imply that there's a single answer to whatever question you're facing. It implies that you really don't have a choice in the matter. Resist the implication. You always have a choice. All this isn't to say that best practices are of no value. They're like training wheels. When you don't know how to keep your balance or how fast to pedal, they can be helpful to get you going. But every best practice should come with a reminder to reconsider. And ultimately, you can't develop a calm culture if you're constantly fretting about what the best practices prescribe and whether you're measuring or messing up. Find what works for you and do that. Create your practices and your patterns. Who cares if they're the best for anyone else? Novelist Haruki Murakami writes international bestsellers and gets to bed by 9 p.m. every night. Whatever it doesn't take. Whatever it takes. It feels good, doesn't it? It's hard to find 3 words loaded with more inspiration, aspiration, and ambition than whatever it takes. It's the rallying cry for captains of industry and war generals alike. Who wouldn't want to be such a hero and a leader? But you're not actually capturing a hill on the beach of Normandy, are you? You're probably just trying to meet some arbitrary deadline set by those who don't actually have to do the work, or trying to meet some fantastical financial stretch goal that nobody who actually has to do the stretching would think reasonable. Whatever it takes is an iceberg. Steer clear lest it literally sink your ship. Just ask Edward Smith, the captain of the Titanic, who gave orders to do whatever it took to get to New York faster than expected to break a record. You probably know how that turned out. Reasonable expectations are out the window with whatever it takes. So you know you're going to grossly underestimate the difficulty and complexity required to make it happen. You almost surely haven't budgeted time, energy, or dollars for whatever it takes. That's code for at all costs. When you stop discussing costs, you know they're going to spiral. You probably aren't ready to say no to all the things you'll have to skip out on because you said yes to whatever it takes. Whatever it takes means you'll probably be working at 10 p.m. on Wednesday. and Thursday, and Friday. Whatever it takes means sloppy work in the service of just delivering something. Whatever it takes means if you won't do it, your boss will find someone else who will. Endure the abuse. If you're in business long enough, there certainly will be rare moments when whatever it takes is truly called for, a real honest emergency. Or maybe because you won't be able to make payroll. Or maybe because inaction will permanently scar your reputation. So yes, there are moments. Rare, extreme moments. Don't drive your everyday business by the fear of those outliers. Here's what we do. Rather than demand whatever it takes, we ask, what will it take? That's an invitation to a conversation. One where we can discuss strategy, make trade-offs, make cuts, come up with a simpler approach altogether, or even decide it's not worth it after all. Questions bring options. Decrees burn them. Have less to do. Time management hacks, life hacks, sleep hacks, work hacks. These all reflect an obsession with trying to squeeze more time out of the day. But rearranging your daily patterns to find more time for work isn't the problem. Too much shit to do is the problem. The only way to get more done is to have less to do. Saying no is the only way to claw back time. Don't shuffle 12 things so that you can do them in a different order. Don't set timers to move on from this or that. Eliminate 7 of the 12 things, and you'll have time left for the 5. It's not time management. It's obligation elimination. Everything else is snake oil. Besides, time isn't something that can be managed. Time is time. It rolls along at the same pace regardless of how you try to wrestle with it. What you choose to spend it on is the only thing you have control over. Management scholar Peter Drucker nailed it decades ago when he said, "There is nothing so useless as doing efficiently that which should not be done at all." Bam! At Basecamp, we've become ruthless about eliminating either work that doesn't need to be done or work we don't want to do. For example, we used to accept payment by credit card and check. Credit cards were entirely automated, so on our side, it didn't take anyone's time to process. But checks were mailed in, which meant someone needed to receive them, process them, deal with incorrect amounts, tie them correctly to the account they were associated with, etc. Now, some companies might say, "Hey, okay, let's hire someone else who can do that specific work." Others might say, "Let's spend some time, money, and technology to automate the process some more." What did we say? We won't accept checks anymore. Yes, we decided to turn away revenue and customers who could only pay by check. But it wasn't really a turn away. It was a trade away. We traded some revenue for some time. We didn't encourage someone to carve out time in their day to deal with manual check processing. Instead, we eliminated work that had to be done by saying no. No more checks. There are surely dozens more things we don't need to be doing at work. We're forever on the lookout and always on the hunt to track them down. Not so that we can check them off the list, but so we can throw them away. Three's Company. Nearly all product work at Basecamp is done by teams of three people. It's our magic number. A team of three is usually composed of two programmers and one designer. And if it's not three, it's one or two rather than four or five. We don't throw more people at problems. We chop problems down until they can be carried across the finish line by teams of three. We rarely have meetings at Basecamp, but when we do, you'll hardly ever find more than three people around a table. Same with conference calls or video chats. Any conversation with more than three people is typically a conversation with too many people. What if there are five departments involved in a project or a decision? There aren't. We don't work on projects like that. Intentionally. What is it with three? Three is a wedge. And that's why it works. Three has a sharp point. It's an odd number, so there are no ties. It's powerful enough to make a dent, but also weak enough to not break what isn't broken. Big teams make things worse all the time by applying too much force to things that only need to be lightly finessed. The problem with 4 is that you almost always need to add a 5th to manage. The problem with 5 is that it's too many. And 6, 7, or 8 on a team will inevitably make simple things more complicated than they need to be. Just like work expands to fill the time available. Work expands to fill the team available. Small short projects quickly become big long projects when too many people are there to work on them. You can do big things with small teams, but it's a whole hell of a lot harder to do small things with big teams. And small things are often all that's necessary. The occasional big thing is great, but most improvements come as small incremental steps. Big teams can step right over those small moves. 3 keeps you honest. It tempers your ambition in all the right ways. It requires you to make trade-offs. And most important, 3 reduces miscommunication and improves coordination. 3 people can talk directly with one another without introducing hearsay. And it's a lot easier to coordinate 3 people's schedules than 4 or more. We love 3. Stick with it. If the boss is constantly pulling people off one project to chase another, nobody's going to get anything done. Pull-offs can happen for a number of reasons, but the most common one is that someone senior has a new idea that just can't wait. These half-baked, right in the middle of something else new ideas lead to half-finished, abandoned projects that litter the landscape and zap morale. That's why rather than jumping on every new idea right away, we make every idea wait a while. Generally, a few weeks at least. That's just enough time either to forget about it completely or to realize you can't stop thinking about it. What makes this pause possible is that our projects don't go on forever. 6 weeks max, and generally shorter. That means we have natural opportunities to consider new ideas every few weeks. We don't have to cut something short to start something new. First, we finish what we started. Then, we consider what we want to tackle next. When the urgency of now goes away, so does the anxiety. This approach also prevents unfinished work from piling up. Having a box full of stale work is no fun. Happiness is shipping, finishing good work, sending it off, and then moving on to the next idea. Besides, the next morning or week has a way of telling the truth. It's good to sleep on something. You might well wake up the next day to see what was the world's best idea yesterday doesn't seem quite as important now. Taking a breather gives you perspective. So give it 5 minutes. Keep your energy focused on finishing what you're working on now, and then decide what to do next once you're done and ready to take on new work. No, no. No is easier to do. Yes is easier to say. No is no to one thing. Yes is no to 1,000 things. No is a precision instrument, a surgeon's scalpel, a laser beam focused on one point. Yes is a blunt object, a club, a fisherman's net that catches everything indiscriminately. No is specific. Yes is general. When you say no to one thing, it's a choice that breeds choices. Tomorrow you can be as open to new opportunities as you were today. When you say yes to one thing, you've spent that choice. The door is shut on a whole host of alternative possibilities, and tomorrow is that much more limited. When you say no now, you can come back and say yes later. If you say yes now, it's harder to say no later. No is calm, but hard. Yes is easy, but a flurry. Knowing what you'll say no to is better than knowing what you'll say yes to. No, no. Composer Gustav Mahler wrote his symphonies during solitary summers in the Alps, where he worked in a small cottage and walked for hours after work. Mind your business. risk without putting yourself at risk. A lot of entrepreneurs are addicted to risk. The bigger, the better. Chasing the thrill, the adrenaline, and the glory that comes from hanging in the balance between winning everything or losing it all. Not us. We don't need to shoot up on risk to get excited about work. We'll take a risk, but we won't put the company at risk. For example, we recently did something that would appear incredibly risky. We more than tripled the entry price of Basecamp. We went from $29 a month to $99 a month. We made some significant improvements to the product at the same time, and the new price didn't apply to everyone. Existing Basecamp customers were grandfathered in at their current prices, but new customers signing up for Basecamp after we made the change were charged $99 a month. Did we test it? No. Did we ask people if they'd be willing to pay more? No. Were we sure it would work? Absolutely not. Sounds risky. But really, what was the risk? Will we go out of business if it didn't work? No. Will we have to lay people off if this wild experiment fell flat? No. Why not? Because we already had a massive base of more than 100,000 customers paying us what they were before. We promised ourselves to give it 6 months and see how it turned out. We tweak it along the way. A big step first, and then small steps as we went. And we could always walk it back if it flopped. That's managed, calculated risk with a safety rope attached. As it turned out, tripling the entry price worked out great. We gave up some new signups, but we more than made up for it with the higher price. That's what we were aiming for. Bullseye. Taking a risk doesn't have to be reckless. You're not any bolder or braver because you put yourself or the business at needless risk. The smart bet is one where you get to play again if it doesn't come up your way. Season's greetings. Change is often seen as stressful, but the polar opposite, monotony, can be even worse. You can only work exactly the same way, at the same pace, doing the same work for so long before monotony bites. When you're growing up, life is seasonal. Even if you live in a place where the weather doesn't change, there's a change in rhythm to the year. There's school, there's summer. Different things happen at different times. But unless you work in a seasonal business, work in March is usually the same as work in May. June's the same as January, and it would be hard to tell December's work from February's work. Not at Basecamp. We celebrate the summer months, in the Northern Hemisphere at least, by cutting out a workday every week. May through September, we work 4-day, 32-hour weeks. The idea isn't to cram more stuff into fewer hours, so we adapt our ambition too. Winter is when we buckle down and take on larger, more challenging projects. Summer, with its shorter 4-day weeks, is when we tackle simpler, lighter projects. We also celebrate the seasons outside of work at Basecamp by covering the cost of a weekly community-supported agriculture share for each employee. Fresh, local, seasonal fruits and veggies in people's homes. This is a year-round benefit, but the bounty naturally changes with the seasons. It's a delicious, healthy way to celebrate change. Be it in hours, degrees of difficulty, or even specific benefits that emphasize seasonality. Find ways to melt the monotony of work. People grow dull and stiff if they stay in the same swing for too long. Calms in the black. From the very first month we started the business back in 1999, we were profitable. We've remained profitable every year since then. We've certainly had our share of good fortune and luck, but we've also intentionally never gotten ahead of ourselves. We've always kept our costs in check and never made a move that would push us back from black to red. Why? Because crazy's in the red. Calm's in the black. Until you're running a profitable business, you're always almost out of business. You're racing the runway, fretting about whether you'll take off in time, worrying about how to make payroll at the last moment if you don't, Talk about a pressurized environment. When companies are in the red, employees worry about their jobs. People aren't stupid. They know that burning cash means the good times won't last. The possibility of layoffs is always nagging. CVs are always at the ready. Revenue alone is no defense either, because revenue without a profit margin isn't going to save you. You can easily go broke generating revenue. Many companies have. But you can't go broke generating a profit. Profit means time to think, space to explore. It means being in control of your own destiny and schedule. Without profit, something is always on fire. When companies talk about burn rates, two things are burning: money and people. One you're burning up, one you're burning out. Astrophysicist Sandra Faber, who has made groundbreaking discoveries about dark matter and how galaxies are formed, said her work benefited from a daily routine where she'd focus on her family during evenings and weekends. Price to lose. The worst customer is the one you can't afford to lose. The big whale that can crush your spirit and fray your nerves with just a hint of their dissatisfaction. These are the customers who keep you up at night. Yet most business software companies, like ours, are irresistibly drawn to the siren song of huge accounts. That's because most business software is sold by the seat. For example, sell to a small company with 7 people at $10 per user, and you'll get a customer worth $70 per month. But land a company with 120 employees at $10 per user, and you score a contract worth $1,200 per month. Then think what a 1,200-employee account would do, or a 12,000-employee account. You can see why huge company accounts are so attractive and addicting. We've rejected the per-seat business model from day one. It's not because we don't like money, but because we like our freedom more. The problem with per-seat pricing is that it makes your biggest customers your best customers. With money comes influence, if not outright power. And from that flows decisions about what and who to spend time on. There's no way to be immune from such pressure once the money is flowing. The only fix is to cap the spigot. So we take the opposite approach. Buy Basecamp today, and it's just $99 a month, flat and fixed. It doesn't matter if you have 5 employees, 50, 500, or 5,000. It's still just $99 a month total. You can't pay us more than that. On the face of it, such a model makes no sense. Any first-year MBA student will tell you as much. You're leaving money on the table. You're letting your biggest customers get too much of a bargain. They wouldn't bat an eye paying 10 times or even 100 times as much. Thanks, but no thanks. Here are a couple of reasons why. First, since no one customer can pay us an outsized amount, no one customer's demands for features or fixes or exceptions will automatically rise to the top. This leaves us free to make software for ourselves and on behalf of a broad base of customers, not at the behest of any single one or a privileged few. It's a lot easier to do the right thing for the many when you don't fear displeasing a few super customers. Second, we wanted to build Basecamp for small businesses like ourselves, members of the Fortune 5 million, and not just build software for them, but really help them. To be honest, we don't really give a shit about the Fortune 500. The corporate behemoths are much more likely to be set in stone and able to change. With the Fortune 5 million, we have a real shot at making a real impact. That's more satisfying work. Third, we didn't want to get sucked into the mechanics that chasing big contracts inevitably leads to. Key account managers, sales meetings, schmoozing. The enterprise sales playbook is well established and repulsive to us. But it's also unavoidable once you open the door to the big bucks from the big shots. Again, no thank you. But then why not just do both? sell to small businesses on one model, and also have a group of people dedicated to servicing big businesses. Because we don't want to be a two-headed company with two cultures. Selling to small businesses and selling to enterprises take two very different approaches with two very different kinds of people. Becoming a calm company is all about making decisions about who you are, who you want to serve, and who you want to say no to. It's about knowing what to optimize for. It's not that any particular choice is the right one, but not making one or dithering is definitely the wrong one. Launch and learn. If you want to know the truth about what you've built, you have to ship it. You can test, you can brainstorm, you can argue, you can survey, but only shipping will tell you whether you're going to sink or swim. Is this thing any good? Does it solve a real problem? Should we have made it better? Are we making what customers want? Is anybody going to buy this? Did we price it right? All good questions. But you can debate this internally forever. And many companies do. In the search for answers, they find anxiety instead. Second guesses, fear, and indecision fill the hallways and offices around the world. But why worry? Do your best. Believe in the work you've done and ship it. Then you'll find out for sure. Maybe it'll be spot on. Maybe it'll suck. Maybe it'll be somewhere in between. But if you want to know, you have to put it on the market, the real market. It's the only place you'll find the truth. You can follow the spec. You can test it forever. You can talk to potential customers and ask them what they'd pay for this thing you're making. You can run surveys and ask people if they'd buy your product if it did this thing or that thing. But so what? Those are simulated answers. They aren't real. Real answers are only uncovered when someone's motivated enough to buy your product and use it in their own natural environment and of their own volition. Anything else is a simulation, and simulated situations give you simulated answers. Shipping real products gives you real answers. At Basecamp, we live this philosophy to the extreme. We don't show any customers anything until every customer can see it. We don't beta test with customers. We don't ask people what they'd pay for something. We don't ask anyone what they think of something. We do the best job we know how to do, and then we launch it into the market. The market will tell us the truth. Do we miss things we could have found had we asked a bunch of people beforehand? Of course. But at what cost? Putting everything we build in front of customers beforehand is slow, costly, and results in a mountain of pre-release feedback that has to be sifted through, considered, debated, discussed, and decided upon. And yet, it's still all just a guess. That's a lot of energy to spend guessing. So do your best and put it out there. You can iterate from there on real insights and real answers from real customers who really do need your product. Launch and learn. Promise not to promise. Since the beginning of Basecamp, we've been loath to make promises about future product improvements. We've always wanted customers to judge the product they could buy and use today, not some imaginary version that might exist in the future. It's why we've never committed to a product roadmap. It's not because we have a secret one in the back of some smoky room we don't want to share, but because one doesn't actually exist. We honestly don't know what we'll be working on in a year, so why act like we do? But when we recently launched an all-new version of Basecamp, we ended up making a promise about the future anyway. Though? See, the new version didn't initially include a feature our customers were clamoring for. Project templates. The requests piled in, the emails piled up. We wanted to do it, but we weren't sure when we'd be able to get to it. So we just told people, by the end of the year. At the time that gave us 8 months or so, which sounded easy, but it discounted all the work it would take to get it done, as well as the other stuff we also had to do at the same time. March ticked by, then April, then May, June, July, and August, we still hadn't started on the project templates feature. And then September and October comes along, and now, to come through on our promise, we had to drop a bunch of other